chief was standing in the doorway of a room. He crooked a finger at Bond in a silent, spidery summons. It was a large bare room, sparsely furnished in cheap French Art Nouveau style. Over by the window was an incongruous-looking throne-like chair in carved oak with a red velvet seat, a low table on which stood an empty water carafe and two glasses, and a light armchair with a round cane seat and no cushion. Le Chiffre pointed at the cane chair. "That will do excellently," he said to the thin man who had followed Bond into the room. "Prepare him quickly. If he resists, damage him only a little." He turned to Bond. "Take off your clothes. For every effort to resist, Basil will break one of your fingers. We are serious people, and your good health is of no interest to us. Whether you live or die depends on the outcome of the talk we are about to have." He made a gesture towards the thin man and left the room. The thin man's first action was a curious one. He opened the clasp knife he had used on the hood of Bond's car, took the small armchair, and with a swift motion, he cut out its cane seat. Then he turned Bond round to the light and unwound the flex from his wrists.
"Vite!"
Bond looked him in the eye and then slowly started to take off his shirt. Le Chiffre came quietly back into the room. He carried a pot of what smelt like coffee. He put it on the small table near the window. He also placed beside it on the table two other homely objects, a 3-foot-long carpet beater in twisted cane and a carving knife. He settled himself comfortably on the throne-like chair and poured some of the coffee into one of the glasses. With one foot, he hooked forward the small armchair, whose seat was now an empty circular frame of wood, until it was directly opposite him. Bond stood stark naked in the middle of the room, bruises showing livid on his white body, his face a grey mask of exhaustion and knowledge of what was to come.
"Sit down there."
Le Chiffre nodded at the chair in front of him. Bond walked over and sat down. The thin man produced some flex. With this he bound Bond's wrists to the arms of the chair and his ankles to the front legs. He passed a double strand across his chest and threw the chair back. He made no mistakes with the knots and left no play in any of the bindings. All of them bit sharply into Bond's flesh. The legs of the chair were broadly spaced and Bond could not even rock it. He was utterly a prisoner, naked and defenceless. His buttocks and the under part of his body protruded through the seat of the chair towards the floor. Le Chiffre nodded to the thin man, who quietly left the room and closed the door. Then he picked up the cane carpet beater, and resting the handle comfortably on his knee, allowed the flat trefoil base to lie on the floor directly under Bond's chair. He looked Bond carefully, almost caressingly, in the eyes. Then his wrist sprang suddenly upwards on his knee. The result was startling. Bond's whole body arched in an involuntary spasm, his face contracted in a soundless scream, and his lips drew right away from his teeth. For an instant, muscles stood out in knots all over his body, and his toes and fingers clenched until they were quite white. Then his body sagged, and perspiration started to bead all over his body. He uttered a deep groan. Le Chiffre waited for his eyes to open.
"You see, dear boy,"
he smiled a soft, fat smile,
"is the position quite clear now?"
A drop of sweat fell off Bond's chin onto his naked chest.
"Now, let us get down to business and see how soon we can be finished with this unfortunate mess you have got yourself into."
He puffed cheerfully at his cigarette.
"My dear boy,"
Le Chiffre spoke like a father,
"the game of Red Indians is over, quite over. You have stumbled by mischance into a game for grown-ups, and you have already found it a painful experience."
He suddenly dropped his bantering tone and looked at Bond sharply and venomously.
"Where is the money?"
Bond's bloodshot eyes looked emptily back at him. Again the upward jerk of the wrist, and again Bond's whole body writhed and contorted. Le Chiffre waited until Bond's eyes dully opened again.
"Perhaps I should explain," said Le Chiffre. "I intend to continue attacking the sensitive parts of your body until you answer my question. If you continue to be obstinate, you will be tortured to the edge of madness, and then the girl will be brought in and we will set about her in front of you. If that is still not enough, you will both be painfully killed, and I shall reluctantly leave your bodies and make my way abroad to a comfortable house which is waiting for me. If you hand the money over, so much the better. If not, I shall shrug my shoulders and be on my way."
He paused, and his wrist lifted slightly on his knee. Bond's flesh cringed as the cane's surface just touched him.
"Well?"
Bond closed his eyes and waited for the pain. Like a rattlesnake, the cane instrument leapt from the floor. It struck again and again so that Bond screamed and his body jangled in the chair like a marionette. Through the red mist of pain, Bond thought of Vesper. He could imagine how she was being used by the two gunmen. Poor wretch to have been dragged into this. Le Chiffre was talking again.
"Torture is a terrible thing," he was saying as he puffed at a fresh cigarette. "But it is a simple matter for the torturer, particularly when the patient," he smiled at the word, "is a man. With this simple instrument, one can cause a man as much pain as is possible. It is not only the immediate agony, but also the thought that your manhood is being gradually destroyed, and that at the end, if you will not yield, you will no longer be a man. That, my dear Bond, is inevitable, unless you tell me where you hid the money."
He poured some more coffee into the glass. Bond raised his head and spoke thickly.
"Money. No good to you."
His voice was a laborious croak.
"Police. Trace it. To you."
Exhausted by the effort, his head sank forward again.
"Ah, my dear fellow, I had forgotten to tell you."
Le Chiffre smiled wolfishly.
"We met after our little game at the casino, and you are such a sportsman that you agreed we would have one more run through the pack between the two of us. It was a gallant gesture, typical of an English gentleman. Unfortunately, you lost, and this upset you so much that you decided to leave Royale immediately for an unknown destination. Like the gentleman you are, you very kindly gave me a note explaining the circumstances so that I would have no difficulty in cashing your check. You see, dear boy, everything has been thought of, and you need have no fears on my account."
He chuckled fatly. So that was the score, thought Bond, with a final sinking of the heart. The unknown destination would be under the ground, or under the sea, or perhaps, more simply, under the crashed Bentley. Well, if he had to die anyway, he might as well try it the hard way. He had no hope that Matisse or Leiter would get to him in time, but at least there was a chance that they would catch up with Le Chiffre before he could get away. It was a choice of evils, but the longer Le Chiffre continued the torture, the more likely he would be revenged. Bond lifted his head and looked Le Chiffre in the eyes. The china of the whites was now veined with red. The upward edges of black coffee at the corners of the mouth gave a false smile.
"No,"
he said flatly. Le Chiffre grunted and set to work again with savage fury. Occasionally he snarled like a wild beast. After 10 minutes, Bond had fainted, blessedly. It was extraordinary to hear the third voice. Bond's dimmed senses hardly took it in. Then suddenly he was halfway back to consciousness. He found he could see and hear again. He could hear the dead silence after the one quiet word from the doorway. He could see Le Chiffre's head slowly come up and the expression of blank astonishment, of innocent amazement, slowly give way to fear.
"Stop,"
had said the voice, quietly. Bond heard slow steps approaching behind his chair. He tried desperately to read into Le Chiffre's face what was happening behind him, but all he saw was blinding comprehension and terror. His hands fluttered vaguely in his lap. His round, staring eyes had lowered for a split second, and Bond guessed there was a gun trained on him. There was a moment's silence.
Smersh.
The word came almost with a sigh. It came with a downward cadence, as if nothing else had to be said. It was the final explanation, the last word of all.
No, said Le Chiffre. No, I...
His voice tailed off. Perhaps he was going to explain, to apologize, but what he must have seen in the other's face made it all useless.
Your two men, both dead. You are a fool and a thief and a traitor. I have been sent from the Soviet Union to eliminate you. We cannot see the end of the trouble you have caused. Do you plead guilty?
Bond wrestled with his consciousness. He screwed up his eyes and tried to shake his head to clear it, but his whole nervous system was numbed and no message was transmitted to his muscles. He could just keep his focus on the great pale face in front of him and on its bulging eyes. A thin string of saliva crept from the open mouth and hung down from the chin.
Yes, said the mouth.
There was a sharp phut, no louder than a bubble of air escaping from a tube of toothpaste. No other noise at all. And suddenly Le Chiffre had grown another eye, right where the thick nose started to jut out below the forehead. It was a small black eye, without eyelashes or eyebrows. For a second, the three eyes looked out across the room. Then the heavy head fell sideways, and finally the whole upper part of the body lurched over the arm of the chair. There was a short rattle of heels on the ground, and then no other movement. A hand came from behind Bond and grasped his chin and pulled it back. For a moment, Bond looked up into two glittering eyes behind a narrow black mask. There was the impression of a crag-like face under a hat brim. He could take in nothing more before his head was pushed down again.
You are fortunate, said the voice. I have no orders to kill you. Your life has been saved twice in one day. But you can tell your organization that Smersh is only merciful by chance or by mistake. I shall leave you my visiting card. You are a gambler. One day perhaps you will play against one of us. It would be well that you should be known as a spy.
There was the click of a knife opening. An arm in some grey material came into Bond's line of vision. A broad, hairy hand emerging from a dirty white shirt cuff was holding a thin stiletto like a fountain pen. It poised for a moment above the back of Bond's right hand. Then the point of the stiletto executed three quick, straight slashes. A fourth slash crossed them where they ended, just short of the knuckles. Blood in the shape of an inverted M welled out and slowly started to drip onto the floor. The pain was nothing to what Bond was already suffering, but it was enough to plunge him again into unconsciousness. The steps moved quietly away across the room. The door was softly closed. You are about to awake when you dream that you are dreaming. During the next 2 days, James Bond was permanently in this state, without regaining consciousness. He watched the procession of his dreams go by. He felt safer in the darkness, and he hugged it to him. On the morning of the third day, a bloody nightmare shook him awake, trembling and sweating. His whole body was strapped down, and something like a large white coffin covered him from chest to feet and obscured his view of the end of the bed. He shouted a string of obscenities, but the effort took all his strength, and the words tailed off into a sob. Tears of forlornness and self-pity welled out of his eyes. A woman's voice was speaking, and the words gradually penetrated to him. It slowly came to him that he was being comforted, and that this was a friend and not an enemy. He could hardly believe it. He had been so certain that he was still a captive, and that the torture was about to begin again. He felt his face being softly wiped with a cool cloth which smelt of lavender, and then he sank back into his dreams. When he awoke again, some hours later, all his terrors had gone, and he felt warm and languorous. Sun was streaming into the bright room, and in the background there was the noise of small waves on a beach. As he moved his head, he heard a rustle, and a nurse who had been sitting beside his pillow rose and came into his line of vision.
"Well, I'm certainly glad you've woken up at last. Never heard such dreadful language in my life."
Bond smiled back at her.
"Where am I?"
he asked, and was surprised that his voice sounded firm and clear. "You're in a nursing home at Royal, and I've been sent over from England to look after you. I'm Nurse Gibson. Now, just lie quiet, and I'll go and tell the doctor you're awake." Bond closed his eyes and mentally explored his body. The worst pain was in his wrists and ankles, and in his right hand where the Russian had cut him. In the centre of the body there was no feeling. He assumed that he had been given a local anaesthetic. The rest of his body ached dully, as if he had been beaten all over. He was preparing a short list of questions in his mind when the door opened, and the doctor came in, followed by the nurse, and in the background the dear figure of Mattis, a Mattis looking anxious behind his broad smile. When the doctor spoke, he was forthright.
"You have a lot of questions to ask, my dear Mr. Bond," he said in excellent English, "and I can tell you most of the answers. I do not want you to waste your strength, so I will give you the salient facts, and then you may have a few minutes with Monsieur Mattis, who wishes to obtain one or two details from you. It is really too early for this talk, but I wish to set your mind at rest so that we can proceed with the task of repairing your body without bothering too much about your mind."
Nurse Gibson pulled up a chair for the doctor and left the room.
"You have been here about 2 days," continued the doctor. "Your car was found by a farmer on the way to market in Royal, and he informed the police. After some delay, Monsieur Mattis heard that it was your car, and he immediately went to Le Chiffre's villa with his men. You and Le Chiffre were found, and also your friend Miss Lind, who was unharmed and, according to her account, suffered no molestation. She was prostrated with shock, but is now fully recovered and is at her hotel."
The doctor paused.
"Your own injuries are serious, but your life is not in danger, though you have lost a lot of blood. If all goes well, you will recover completely, and none of the functions of your body will be impaired."
"For how long were you maltreated?"
"About an hour," said Bond. "Then it is remarkable that you are alive, and I congratulate you. Few men could have supported what you have been through."
The doctor looked at Bond for a moment, and then turned brusquely to Mattis.
"You may have 10 minutes, and then you will be forcibly ejected. If you put the patient's temperature up, you will answer for it."
He gave them both a broad smile and left the room. Mattis came over and took the doctor's chair.
"I have a personal message from M," he said. "He spoke to me himself on the telephone. He simply said to tell you that he is much impressed. I asked if that was all, and he said, 'Well, tell him that the Treasury is greatly relieved.' Then he rang off."
Bond grinned with pleasure. This was quite unheard of. The very existence of M, let alone his identity, was never admitted. He could imagine the flutter this must have caused in the ultra-security-minded organization in London.
"A tall, thin man with one arm came over from London the same day we found you," continued Mattis. "He seemed to be Vesper's boss. He spent a lot of time with her and gave her strict instructions to look after you."
"Head of S," thought Bond. "They're certainly giving me the red carpet treatment."
"Now," said Mattis, "to business. Who killed Le Chiffre?"
"Smash," said Bond. Mattis gave a low whistle.
"My God," he said respectfully. "So they were on to him. What did he look like?"
Bond explained briefly what had happened up to the moment of Le Chiffre's death, omitting all but the most essential details. It cost him an effort. Casting his mind back to the scene awoke the whole nightmare, and as the sweat began to pour off his forehead, Mattis realized that he was going too far. He laid a hand on Bond's shoulder.
"Forgive me, my friend," he said. "It is all over now, and you are in safe hands. One last mystery, and then I promise I will go. What about the money? Where is it? Where did you hide it?
We have been over your room with a tooth comb. It isn't there.
Bond grinned. It is, he said, more or less. On the door of each room there is a small square of black plastic with the number of the room on it. On the corridor side, of course. When Leiter left me that night, I simply opened the door and unscrewed my number plate and put the folded check underneath it. It'll still be there. Mattis laughed delightedly.
I suppose you think that paid me back for knowing what the Munces were up to. Well, I'll call it quits.
He rose hastily as the doctor stormed into the room and took one look at Bond.
Out, he said to Mattis. Out and don't come back.
Mattis just had time to wave cheerfully to Bond and call some hasty words of farewell before he was hustled through the door. Bond lay back, exhausted, but heartened by all he had heard. He found himself thinking of Vespa, as he quickly drifted off into a troubled sleep. There were still questions to be answered, but they could wait. Bond made good progress. When Mattis came to see him 3 days later, the lower half of his body was still shrouded in the oblong tent, but he looked cheerful, and it was only occasionally that a twinge of pain narrowed his eyes. Mattis looked crestfallen.
"Here's your check," he said to Bond. "I've rather enjoyed walking around with 40 million francs in my pocket. There is no sign of our friend from Smersh. Not a damn trace."
"He's probably back home by now, being told off for not shooting me," said Bond. "I fancy they've got quite a file on me, in view of one or two of the jobs M's given me since the war." He obviously thought he was being smart enough, cutting his initial in my hand.
"What's that?" asked Mattis. "The doctor said the cuts looked like a square M with a tail to the top. He said they didn't mean anything."
"Well, I only got a glimpse before I passed out. But I'm pretty certain they are the Russian letter for SH. It's rather like an inverted M with a tail. That would make sense. Smersh is short for Schmiert Spionem, death to spies, and he thinks he's labelled me as a spion. It's a nuisance because M will probably say I've got to go to hospital again when I get back to London and have new skin grafted over the hole at the back of my hand. It doesn't matter much. I've decided to resign." Mattis looked at him with his mouth open.
"Resign?" he asked incredulously. "What's hell for?"
Bond looked away from Mattis. He studied his bandaged hands. "When I was being beaten up," he said, "I suddenly liked the idea of being alive." Before Le Chiffre began, he used a phrase which stuck in my mind. "Playing Red Indians." He said that's what I had been doing. Well, I suddenly thought he might be right. "You see," he said, still looking down at his bandages, "when one's young, it seems very easy to distinguish between right and wrong, and one grows up wanting to be a hero and kill the villains." He looked obstinately at Mattis. "Well, in the last few years, I've killed 2 villains. The first was in New York, a Japanese cipher expert cracking our codes. It was a pretty sound job, nice and clean, too. The next time in Stockholm wasn't so pretty. I had to kill a Norwegian who was doubling against us for the Germans. And, well, he just didn't die very quickly. For those 2 jobs, I was awarded a 00 number in the service. A 00 number in our service means you've had to kill a chap in cold blood in the course of some job. Now," he looked up again at Mattis, "that's all very fine. The hero kills 2 villains, but when the hero Le Chiffre starts to kill the villain Bond, and the villain Bond knows he isn't a villain at all, you see the other side of the medal. The villains and heroes get all mixed up. This country right or wrong business is getting a little out of date. Today we are fighting communism. If I had been alive 50 years ago, the brand of conservatism we have today would have been damn near communism, and we would have been told to go and fight that. History is moving pretty quickly. And the heroes and villains keep on changing parts." Mattis stared at him aghast. Then he tapped his head and put a calming hand on Bond's arm.
You mean to say that this precious Le Chiffre, who did his best to turn you into a eunuch, doesn't qualify as a villain? He asked. You wait till M tells you to get after another Le Chiffre. I bet you'll go after him all right. And what about Smash? I can tell you I don't like the idea of these chaps running around France, killing anyone they feel has been a traitor to their precious political system.
Mathis paused at the door.
When you get back to London, you will find there are other Le Chiffres seeking to destroy you and your friends and your country. M will tell you about them. And now that you have seen a really evil man, you will know how evil they can be, and you will go after them to destroy them in order to protect yourself and the people you love. You may want to be certain that the target really is black, but there are plenty of really black targets around. And when you fall in love and have a mistress or a wife and children to look after, it will seem all the easier.
Mathis opened the door and stopped on the threshold.
Surround yourself with human beings, my dear James. They are easier to fight for than principles.
He laughed. But don't let me down and become human yourself. We would lose such a wonderful machine. With a wave of the hand, he shut the door.
Hey!
Shouted Bond. But the footsteps went quickly off down the passage.